to Joanne Stevens. Joanne, may I turn things over to you?
Yes, thank you. Welcome everyone to VIREX Fiscal Year 2024 Good Data Practices Cyber Seminar Series. And thank you to Whitney Lee at CIDR for providing technical and promotional support for this series. Thanks also to Molly Kessner, VIREX Cyber Seminar Coordinator, and Linda Koch, Data Access and Policy Workgroup Lead. VIREX supports VHA data users by developing and disseminating knowledge about VA data and improving the data use environment for research. The Good Data Practices Cyber Seminar Series is just one of our many tools for reaching out to VA users throughout the field. VIREX Good Data Practices Series is being held according to the schedule listed on this slide. More information about this series and other VIREX Cyber Seminars is available on VIREX website, and past sessions can be viewed on HSR's VIREX Cyber Seminar Archive. A quick reminder to those of you just signing on, slides are available to download. This is a screenshot of a sample email you should have received today before the session. And in that message, you will find the link to download the slides. Before introducing our speaker today, we have a couple of poll questions. We look forward to getting to know our audience, and your responses help us to do that and to plan future sessions. You will see the pop-up for responding to these polls shortly. So while Whitney's putting those up for you, I'm going to read off the possible choices. Investigator, principal investigator, co-investigator, statistician, methodologist, biostatistician, data manager, analyst or programmer, project coordinator, or others such as an IRB administrator, clinical nurse, research data ethicist, et cetera. And these are regarding, this question is regarding your primary role in projects using VA data. On the second question, it's asking how many years of experience do you have working with VA data? None, you're brand new to this, 1 year or less, more than one or less than 3 years, at least three, less than 7 years, at least seven, less than 10 years, 10 years or more, or if you've had none, you know, again, that would be zero. And Whitney will be reading off the poll results in a few seconds when things slow down.
Okay. Okay, so our answers are streaming in quite rapidly. We just have a few more people who are still in progress, so I'll just let them make their choices. To our attendees, please remember to scroll down so you can get to the second question, and also to hit submit once you've selected both of your answer choices. All right, things have slowed down, so I'll go ahead and close out this poll and share the results. For what is your primary role, we have 14% said A, investigator PI co-I, 9% said B, statistician, methodologist, biostatistician, 17% say C, data manager, analyst, or programmer, 19% say D, project coordinator, and 10% say E, other, and some of those other are research manager, quality assurance nurse. And then for poll two, how many years of experience, we have 5% said none, I'm brand new to this. 7% said B, 1 year or less, 11% said C, more than one, less than three, 14% said D, at least three, less than seven, and then lastly, 8% said E, at least seven, less than 10, and lastly, 11% said F, 10 years or more. Thank you, everyone. Back to you, Joanne.
Okay, thanks, Whitney. So today's session is titled Notes to Your Future Self, the Living Protocol. Matt Medjewski, PhD, is a professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at Duke University. He is also a senior research career scientist and director of the Non-Randomized Design Lab in the Center of Innovation to Accelerate Discovery and Practice Transformation, otherwise known as the ADAPT COIN, at the Durham VA Medical Center. Dr. Medjewski also holds adjunct professor appointments in the Schools of Public Health and Pharmacy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His areas of expertise include health services research, health economics, health policy, and multi-morbidity. Dr. Medjewski has received funding from the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Disease, otherwise known as NIDDK, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, VA Health Systems Research, and the RWJ, or Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, to conduct evaluations of long-term clinical and economic outcomes of surgical interventions, behavioral interventions, and Medicare program policy changes on patients with obesity or cardiometabolic conditions. Questions that are sent through the WebEx chat box will be monitored during today's talk and, as Whitney indicated earlier, presented to Dr. Medjugorje at the end of the session. And for your awareness, at the end of the session, a brief evaluation will pop up on your screen. We ask, if possible, that you please stay until the very end and take a few moments to complete the evaluation. Without further delay, I turn the microphone over to Dr. Medjugorje.
Thanks very much. Nice to present to you all today. I will say that VA has been very good to me. In 4 months, I'll have my 26th year in the VA. And so what I'm going to present to you is definitely informed by all that research I've done over that time. So let's begin. Sort of the roadmap of issues that we're going to discuss are these here. Basically, timely and complete documentation can be tedious, but can be really valuable in ways that I'll get into, and then talk about some of the specific aspects of documentation in terms of study design, measurement, and analysis, and then wrap up. So as I got into being a PI, I recognized that I got no guidance essentially in graduate school about starting my research career, or in looking in the literature about how to work with a team and work and create psychologically safe environments within teams, how to operationalize a protocol once you've gotten the grant funded, how to prioritize the order of tasks in conducting a study, a big data study, and then how to document data and changes. On the research teams I worked on in graduate school, I don't think they did some of this stuff. So it's something I just evolved in collaboration with a longtime collaborator when I was in Seattle, Fen Liu, and then carried forward once I moved to Durham. So what I'm going to try to do is show examples of how I conduct tasks in a timely manner after making key decisions in the development of studies, because the proposals we write are typically a pretty high level overview and don't really get into the weeds, some of which you can anticipate and some of which you may not. And in the decisions that you can't anticipate, you'll have alternatives and you have to weigh those with your team and then hopefully document them clearly so that you have a record of that for subsequent purposes that I'll get into. And so what I'm going to share with you is essentially learning by mistake, by not developing living protocols faithfully, and then begging, borrowing, and stealing best practices from friends and colleagues around the VA and outside of the VA. And so there are a number of benefits to timely and complete documentation. It enables easy recall for manuscript writing, because often you'll be doing data work that some elements of which will require detailing in a manuscript or an appendix. Years after you did the original work and made the initial decisions. And if you don't have documentation of that, then it can be very hard to recall or recollect what you did. It can also, having documentation also may allow you to apply components of what you've done to future work. If you're going to use coding for variable definition or outcome definition, which enables you to leverage the work that you did, all that work with your team to make it easier down the road. And increasingly, journals are going to be requiring submission of protocols. They already do for trials. Journals are starting to welcome submission of protocols for non-randomized studies, and I would expect that to only increase over time. And so that can be useful for that purpose as well. The most immediate application of this that really prompted me to try to really do this systematically is when writing manuscripts, right? You have to describe your results. What are the issues in the design and measurement and analysis that you used, and the rationale for those choices that you may sometimes have to get into? I am a little methods oriented myself, and so, you know, care about those things greatly. And so having clear documentation of the alternatives and the reason why we chose option 3 instead of options 1 and 2 can sometimes help making the methods section of your papers easier to write. And so a living protocol is really the best source for the logic of your choices. And if you can just draw from text that you've already drafted years prior, it's a lot easier than trying to do the hard thing, which is subject to recall bias, which is going back to minutes, asking your programmer analyst, looking at any notes you might have that might be written and incomplete. And so the alternative to that is a more comprehensive summary, which I will say does take real time to do faithfully, but can be really worth it. And if, heaven forbid, your programmers are gone, your PhD statisticians are gone, and you have not done that work yourself, how can you describe faithfully what was done? That's like the worst case scenario, how a living protocol can be most helpful. And so tips for managing this and in team meetings. So we meet routinely as teams, whether it's a VA grant or a university-based grant, on bi-monthly calls, particularly now in this post-COVID world. We're not all meeting in a conference room like we used to before the pandemic. And so we have a set call with a set agenda. We have analysts and statisticians update us on data issues and where they are in programming based on action items from the last meeting. If there are issues or problems or questions, something that we hadn't fully anticipated, there's some decision that needs to be made that the analyst needs us to settle before being able to sort of finalize something we've settled on, then we talk about that. That's sort of at the top of each agenda. If sometimes we'll review a recent article that'll help us stay up on the literature, if we know we're going to be writing a paper in one particular area and we want to sort of figure out what literature we want to call on to reference as comparing and contrasting with our work, we may read some article together as a team. And then, you know, we may need to get into some current issue that's a new thing, not only sort of things that are in process, but sort of things that we're anticipating that we're going to have to address, say, a month from now. You start trying to lay out the alternatives for some decision and what might be some sense of what are the pros and cons of each alternative so that we can start as a team kind of planting the seed of really having to make a decision. I did this recently in a recent study, and I'll give an example of that in a minute, based on something that we're not in the process of doing, but we're about to. And so we want to sort of not, we want to make sure our analysts, we want to be aware of when they're going to be completing ongoing work so that we are have teed up the next work that needs to be done and not have a lull, because particularly with Vinci issues, as you all know, it's trying to be as streamlined as possible in the conduct of our work. And then fundamentally, we document our key decisions in a decision log, which is, and that log may have be broken up into a log in the design study design section and a log in the, you know, outcomes definition section and a log in the covariate section and a log in the analysis section, something like that. Or you can have one long one and you just have a column that indicates, is this a study design issue? Is this a measurement issue? Is this an analysis issue? Is this some other issue? And then we end the meeting with, okay, well, what next? And then if need be, we have ad hoc calls to work through tricky issues in subgroups. And for example, we were trying to define some outcomes that are diagnosis based in the transition from ICD-9 to ICD-10, and we're able to borrow coding definitions based on ICD-9 diagnoses, but nobody had ICD-10 diagnoses available. So we had to do all that work of doing that crosswalk. I think we're past that now, but that's just an example. And so here's an example of ad hoc work that we're doing right now. We kicked this off on a call last week where I have a paper out now looking at long-term costs of patients who had bariatric surgery in Kaiser Permanente compared to cost of patients who did not have bariatric surgery. And we looked at inpatient admissions and found that the surgical patients had higher all-cause inpatient admissions in the 5.5 years after surgery. And based on earlier work that we'd done just like that in a VA cohort, we'd seen a similar thing, but we didn't really know what were the specific types of admissions that were driving this higher level of all-cause admissions in bariatric patients. So we want to essentially do that work of disaggregating the all-cause admissions into some sensible buckets. And so the first call that we had last week was to sort of talk out this general problem. I came up with a general classification system of surgery-related admissions and non-surgery-related admissions, some which are elective, some which are not. to just give them something to react to, get their juices flowing, got some reactions, and now I'm going to go back and revise that. And then come back to them with a revised classification system. Hopefully we can get to agreement on what that'll be in the final kind of set of buckets. And then once we've got that, then we can sort of divide and conquer on figuring out how we're actually going to measure hospitalizations in each of those buckets. And so hopefully over the next 8 to 16 weeks, we'll be able to iterate on this classification system and get in the literature to figure out the measurement issues. And then we'll document all this in a protocol that I've, for this paper that I've already started. And so the design phase of this study, in terms of a living protocol, it's generally always the same, right? Every study has some sort of design, randomized or not, and you have to articulate in your grant proposal the inclusion exclusion criteria, at least at a high level, even if you don't have all the measurement details of the what ICD-9 codes or other codes you would use, stop codes for inclusion exclusion. But you have to do this sometime, so a living protocol is a good way to do that. Also, then we have to define how are we going to actually identify the treatment group of patients who had bariatric surgery and the comparator of the patients who were eligible for surgery but didn't get it, say, right? You can talk about that in general terms, but ultimately you have to really run that down so your analyst has very precise definition for that stuff, and a living protocol is a good place to put it. I do a lot of weighting or matching in the non-randomized work that I do because unmatched groups tend to be imbalanced in observed and unobserved ways. So we have to think about how we're going to handle imbalance and observed covariates through weighting or matching, and how we're going to handle unobserved confounding as well. And so there are lots of different ways to do weighting and matching and covariate specification of those different methods. So, you know, those sections of this living protocol in my work tends to be pretty extensive. It was at the beginning when we were really kicking the tires on a new matching method called sequential stratification that we've used a lot. And now it's a bit shorter because we can refer back to that prior protocol. And then we have a section on measurement, which is how are we defining actually the outcomes? How are we defining the covariates for matching or weighting? How are we defining the covariates for descriptive purposes? How are we defining the covariates for regression adjustments? And then a whole bunch of details about how are we doing descriptive analysis? Are we going to use standardized mean differences? Are we going to use p-values? What types of regression methods are going to do for each outcome? Are the covariates going to differ even if the cohort stays constant across outcomes, right? The outcomes themselves may have different kinds of distributions and so may require different regression methods. If we have sensitivity analyses that we're planning, we explicitly try to summarize those in the analysis section as well. So the study design issues that sort of that really kicked us off for the first time, which has really been articulated in target trial emulation methods that you may have seen by Miguel Hernan, is we try to think about, frankly, what's the ideal randomized trial, even if it's not feasible or ethical or financially viable, and then how does that differ from what we actually are stuck with? Because having that, thinking about the trial, target trial you're trying to emulate, helps surface the internal validity threats that you may have, which then you can address potentially through study design or measurement or worst case scenario matching analysis. And so I think kind of the cohort derivation things are the issues that I've sort of already talked about. And so these are key issues to document, particularly if it's the first time you're implementing a study design, or you're extending from a study design you know to something different, say from a cross-sectional cohort study to a longitudinal cohort study as we were. Things get a bit more complicated when you're doing something new, and it's worth going through the trouble to work through things with your team. It's also, by developing this protocol, it's a great opportunity to really engage your whole study team. And because in a way, like, you're really doing the science in trying to work through these issues and then document them. And for me, that's kind of the funnest part of the project, is developing what we're going to do. And we had an opportunity to do this in the Cork work with the COVID-19 observational research collaboratory. Okay, let me keep going. So study design, we always outline what are the major threats to internal validity since we're doing observational or quasi-experimental studies. And so here's literal quotes from the bariatric surgery protocol that I worked on now some time ago. It was a retrospective pre-post cohort study with a non-equivalent set of controls. They were non-equivalent because they weren't on average similar to the surgical patients, but they were eligible as far as we could tell. That was the term eligibles underlined because the criteria that would get somebody into a randomized trial of bariatric surgery, we don't observe all the things that might in our data that might be deemed considered for eligibility, like mental health conditions or social support. We don't always have the things that trials might ask about prospectively. So we raise those issues in this section and in the measurement section, if we can find ways to proxy the things that might be relevant for inclusion exclusion. And then the pre-post cohort clearly sets out sort of a basic study design issue, and the non-equivalence again is about not being similar on average. And by not being similar on average, that raises an issue of selection bias, AKA, unobserved confounding, maybe observed confounding as well. And so when we worry about unobserved and observed confounding, then we start thinking about the measurement issues. And we also think about things about how do people get into the cohort and how might we observe their experience over time once they enter the cohort, right? And so what this figure is showing was a snapshot of a piece of the protocol from this bariatric surgery study, characterizing what we might see in terms of data, both measurements of BMI, that is weight in the data by the small X's, and the leftmost column represents kind of the start of the cohort. And then we see at the in the first sort of line called sporadic and alive, a veteran comes in twice over like a 10-year period, but we never see any evidence of their death. Whereas the second person only came in once in the VA and then never again. And, this person who's the one-off and alive person, is there a need to censor that kind of person? Because if they don't come back, but we think they're alive, what does that mean in terms of if the outcome is cost, should we set that time after we see them when they don't come back to the VA for a long time? Should we set that to zero cost, or should we set that to missing after some time, right? These are the sorts of questions that a figure like this kind of can surface. And then there's the more common experience of people coming into the VA regularly and they're alive the whole time. The prodigal son, where they're in for a burst, maybe they go away because they get a job and then they are not employed again and they come back to the VA and we see another burst of VA activity. And all sorts of permutations from there. So having something like this, if you're looking at outcomes over time, may be useful. Even in a cross-sectional context, it may be useful to make such a figure. And it can be a nice way to engage your study team to say, hey, do you think this represents the most likely scenarios of data generation that we're going to see? Are there other patterns we might need to think about that might inform how we think about cohort construction and censoring and other issues? Do we need to update our covariates in any way based on the patterns of utilization that we see that's implied by these different patterns? All these kind of issues come up in thinking about a figure like this. And then we have to think about the treatment group. What data sets are we going to use? Is what types of variables to actually identify them? If it's bariatric procedure, it's CPT-4 and ICD-10 procedure codes. Is it medications? Is it stop codes? What is it? sometimes that's easy. Sometimes that's not so easy. Do the identification or coding rules change over time? They did as ICD-10 was introduced because we had to identify ICD-9 and ICD-10 procedure codes. Thankfully, CPT-4 procedure codes were constant, so that wasn't an issue. And how do we validate things if there's changes to make sure we're still identifying our treatment group like we were used to doing with the new coding system? Those are relevant. And so here's an example of the ICD-9 to ICD-10 conversion. So we, after reaching out to our social networks, I learned that essentially nobody doing bariatric surgery research now 10 years ago had a this ICD-9 to ICD-10 crosswalk in hand. So we reached out to the Surgical Society to ask them, since they were giving advice to surgeons about coding rules, if they would share it with us. And so they did, and then we sort of kicked the tires on these by reaching out to other bariatric surgery research colleagues and iterated on this till we got down to this table. And so, you know, it turned out this table wasn't quite right. So this is very much a living protocol in the sense that this is what we implemented, actually ended up having to undergo revision with a subsequent project that we did because a couple of them were incorrect. But we were going on the best knowledge that we had at the time. And so then in terms of the BMI data that we had to characterize, because we wanted to measure a BMI at baseline, that is just before surgery, to characterize weight change or BMI over time. And so we tallied this information about who actually had weight data in the VA medical record on the day of surgery. How many had it, you know, 6 months leading up to surgery? How many had it from some old study? I don't quite remember what that means. And how many are missing it because it was kind of too far before surgery to, we thought, be valid? Because we know that people change weight dramatically in the months leading up to surgery. And this seemed like super neurotic or something, super in the weeds, but it turns out that it really helped us write this sentence in our 2016 paper, because a reviewer asked us, well, how many people actually had measurements on the day of surgery, and how many measurements did they have, how many days before, and all this, like, very ticky-tack, very technical information that would have been tremendously painful to have to go back years after we constructed the cohort to figure this out. But because we had this table in our living protocol, it was very easy for us to go back and write this sentence in response to the reviewer request. It's hard to predict what reviewers are going to ask for, so we got lucky, let me say. And there are other things that they asked for that we didn't have the information on, but by being able to be precise about this, they let it slide on the other stuff. So other measurement issues are, like, you know, what are the data sets that you're drawing covariates from, and what are the variables on which you're basing some? You know, there are some variables that you ultimately create that are based on a composite of variables across different data sets. And being able to document that clearly will make it a lot easier the next time you have to construct such a variable again. Obviously, you have to define your outcomes. There's data cleaning rules and coding decisions you have to make. There may be frequency distributions that you want to characterize to make sense of how to do final definitions. Sometimes you want those intermediate frequency distributions, or at least summaries of what you were looking at, to help you remember how you got to the ultimate outcome definition. And then similarly for covariates. And so this is a table that I have used on a number of instances, which is a high level review of all the data sets that we're going to pull from. In the proposal, we said we're going to pull from these data sets and just listed them right in a sentence. But with this, we're sort of breaking it out to say, okay, what aims do we need each of these data sets for? What is the outcome for which we need that data set? What's the covariates, generally speaking, that we need this data set for? What's the range of years we need for the surgical cases and for the controls, if relevant? And we have additional details. This is the high level overview. And then we have a subsequent table that, which is here, that I found it very illuminating one day when I realized, like, we want covariates for blank. We're just going to construct these covariates, but there's actually at least five reasons for generating covariates or variables, let's say, outcomes and covariates, inclusion, exclusion, propensity score, or other model for selection bias, covariates for the outcome model, that is for regression adjustment, some covariates are the indicator itself, and some variables are outcomes. The selection of covariates is obviously study specific and is informed by maybe your DAG or the literature that's relevant to your area. But sort of by thinking about these five purposes for covariates, I created this table so that this table is a super long multiple page table that lists every single covariate that we want and the reason for it. Is it inclusion, exclusion? Is it for matching? Is it an outcome, weight change, disease, whatever, right? Are these, if it's a check under weight change, disease, resolution, survival, or utilization, it means those are covariates that we want to adjust for in these models and probably have in the table one for the paper for that outcome. But you'll notice that VISN, we decided only to adjust in the utilization and cost outcome regression, not in survival, disease resolution, or weight change. And similarly, distance to closest VAMC, we thought was important to, as a predictor of survival and utilization, but not for disease resolution or weight change, right? So by creating such a table that's specific to the covariates and the outcomes that you're interested in, you can engage your team. This is maybe not the funnest thing to do, but it can be incredibly helpful so that you don't set up an analytic data set, run some results, and then somebody on your team says, oh, what about variable X? And you're like, ah, oh, geez, yeah, we got to go back. We have to construct that. We got to update the analytic data set. We have to redo everything. So by having a table like this and working through it with your team, you can a priori get everybody's thoughts out on the table and really kick the tires on your covariate specification for regression, say, or for matching, before you have to go back and iterate and iterate and iterate. And early in my career, I redid some analysis like 3 or 4 times fully. Like it took 2 years. What should have taken 6 to 8 months ended up taking 2 years, because after doing it the first time, we were like, oh, we completely forgot some fundamental issue. I don't remember what it was, and had to go back and redo it. And then we redid it all, and then it was like, oh yeah, surfaced this other issue. And that kind of got burned by that experience and want to avoid that. And one way to do that is doing a table like this, that you hand to your team blank and then have everybody fill it in together. You sit in a room or get on Zoom and sort of walk through it. And then there's documentation around analysis, which I think of as it being informed by target trial emulation, right? You can think about missing data, what descriptive statistics, what internal validity threats do you have to think about? And you go through this aim by aim, because if the cohort's changing in some ways across aims, then it may be that the internal validity threats that apply in one aim may not hold quite as much, or new internal validity threats may be relevant. And so you got to really think about that aim by aim. And in theory, we should do all this work before we start analysis. And an ideal example of such a thing is the Oregon Health Insurance Group, that is folks out of Harvard and MIT, actually developed protocols and posted them on a public website that is available today. If you go do a Google search on Oregon Health Insurance Experiment, and you can see the protocol that they developed. And I think it has some amendments to it as well, but they kind of thought everything through and then got into the data, into the analysis. And that's in some sense, maybe an ideal way to do things. In reality, we don't always do it that way. Eventually, if journals requires all to have published protocols before publication of the final results, the way a lot of trials have to do now, then doing this kind of work will make that easier, the transition to that world easier. And so here's an example of a snapshot of a decision log, where we indicate the date of a decision, who was involved in it, what the decision was, the alternatives that were considered, some summary of the rationale, and then the action items, right? So you can imagine if there's 500 decisions to be made over the course of a project, this can get quite tedious. And I have to admit, you know, reviewing minutes is not my favorite thing to do, but it's really useful. And writing these was not super fun, but it was really helpful because we made decisions and documented them well, so that when we went back to, if somebody on the study team said, well, what are the inclusion exclusion criteria again? Why didn't we think about doing this exclusion? We can go back here and say, well, this is what we decided. And in the case of where, if there's an alternative considered, well, what risk adjustment did we choose? We can say, well, we chose the V21 for some brief summary reason we have here. So this isn't simple, but if you work this into your study flow, your project flow, whether it's the PI doing this or the lead methodologist or the project coordinator, you know, it depends on what you're comfortable with, but it can be really helpful as a reference. And then lastly, having documentation on the SAS programs that are used or the R, what state with what have you, can be really helpful so that you know if a new analyst has to come in and the original analyst has left, that there is kind of a flow of programs that a new person could pick up, get familiar with, and hopefully get back up to speed without too much effort. GitHub now being available, I developed these slides at a time when GitHub hadn't yet become so dominant. And so GitHub makes this a lot easier than it used to be. And if you don't use GitHub, I would highly recommend it. If I was programming this today, I would be using GitHub all the time for my teams, but I'm not personally, but I have colleagues who do and think it's great. All right, I went pretty fast, but in conclusion, the living protocol can be useful to have a summary of the reflection on the alternatives leading into a decision and then the decision that you made and why. And if there's evolution in the decisions, to document how that decision evolved, because it otherwise, you know, it really would be the only historical record. Our memories are faulty. And so having some detailed summary can just help you in documenting for papers, future documentation for future work that hopefully you can reuse stuff that you've developed and documented so carefully. And you can hand it, say, if you've got fellows, another reason that just occurred to me is like, if you bring a fellow into your study and you want to help that fellow get up to speed on sort of knowing the guts of your project, you can hand them the grant that you got funded and then the living protocol that gets in the weeds. And it can, particularly for clinician fellows who may not have a lot of experience getting in the weeds on data and study design like this, it can be very helpful in helping them realize and understand the complexity of doing good science and why big data work does take some time. Should be faster than trials, but not always. And then you can sometimes have a resource guide that can help you lift things for use other places or to share with colleagues. If, you know, I a few times have wanted to identify diagnosed hypertension and have asked for code lists from, you know, 5 of my closest colleagues. And every set of codes isn't the same. And so it can be useful to sometimes look at the alternatives and formally evaluate with your clinician colleagues whether this code or that code should be omitted or included or what. So there is a lot more use to this than you might think, despite the tediousness of it. Okay, well, I kind of burned through those slides fast. So I'll stop there and take questions.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, there's right now there's no questions that are in the Q&A section. I think people are thinking about what you talked about, because I imagine that this work, one, takes a number of years and you've been doing this for a long time, and that projects themselves, you know, are completed over several years' time as well. So, you know, is there any other someone has just asked, so I'll ask the question. Do you teach a course or workshop on this topic?
No, I do not. This is it.
Okay. And is there any specific software that you use, such as OneNote?
My project coordinator has been trying to get me to use OneNote. I have not. I'm a Luddite in some respects, so I just have a Word document effectively, right? Essentially, I use the funded grants as the beginning. Obviously, I just take the relevant sections and then we build from there in a Word document. But that there's probably much more elegant ways to do it than that, but that's what I do.
Okay, thank you. And another person asked if you'd be able to share your templates with them. Can they write to you and ask for those?
Sure, yeah, happy to, yeah, no problem.
Okay, and we'll display that slide in just a second. So anyway, those are the only questions that, here comes another one. So from a regulatory perspective, are you keeping protocols open for years after they are completed, since you need to go back to look at the data?
So I know there's a lot of variability in how long people keep protocols open. I typically don't need the data. I did actually just get an email yesterday requesting like a summary of data underlying a figure from that 2016 paper. But I tend to close my protocols once the last paper's accepted. Not always. If there's a fellow who I know is going to be coming and working with me on something, then I'll keep it open for that purpose. But I like to be fairly neat and tidy with my regulatory stuff. And so, no, I don't keep stuff open. The documentation in these living protocols has a lot of the information. The programs themselves can be accessed without any issue, as far as I understand. It's the data itself that needs to be sequestered.
Right. And, you know, just an FYI for the audience, because we're having a session in a couple of weeks about what to do when you close your study. We'll be talking about some of those records, et cetera. Another question that came in is, how do you budget for your and your staff's time for all this work? Has there been any pushback from funders?
I have just bumped up my effort and my project coordinator's effort a little bit above what I normally would. I don't formally call this out in the budget justification. So, you know, so no, I haven't had pushback, but that's because I do those practices and haven't had an issue. If you were to have a formal budget justification around that, then I'd be curious what the reaction would be. I would hope they would be sympathetic with the allocation of effort.
And I imagine that would take some conversation with the project officers as well.
I would guess so. Yeah, I don't think, right? In the same way that with new the data sharing that is expected at NIH and NVA, right? At the end of studies, if we have to prepare data sets for public availability and documentation to go with it, right? I think that's going to be the bigger hurdle, right? That's a new thing that we're all going to have to justify clearly in our grants. And so we're not yet at best practices at that, I would guess. So if you have text that flies with funders and project officers for that work, it should be a piece of cake to get it for this kind of stuff.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. I'll see if there's another one that came in. No, I think that is the end of our, go ahead, Linda.
This is Linda, hi. Hi, Matt. I think that I remember that you used a kind of standard set of procedures that you put together that you follow through every different protocol that you work on. How important is it for you to have those similar or standard procedures for your team?
So I'll answer in a way that maybe you might not expect, I guess. The first is I've been fortunate to be able to work with a lot of the same team with across VA studies, the bariatric studies at least, and on my Duke-based work. And so we sort of have developed a team dynamic and sort of everybody sort of gets on the same page. Having standard procedures can help when you have team members coming in and out. Maybe the team composition isn't totally turning over, but you have a new analyst coming in because somebody leaves. It can help maintain the same level of rigor and transparency and sort of group dynamic to have those standard operating kind of procedures. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
We do have another question that came in. Since we have time, I'm going to read this one too. Do you keep your living protocol separate from your official protocol, which might or might not need to be submitted to an IRB, et cetera? Are you using version control on your protocol documents so you can have internal sections and formal sections separately?
Yes, I do. Essentially, the funded protocol is not touched unless we have to do something in response to the IRB. And so this living protocol is a separate document entirely. We do have version control on it. Sort of funny story. We had a document that I thought we were done with, and I called it _last, foolishly, and it kept being changed. So I was like, okay, call that one underscore last. Okay, this one is really last, to the point where we had to abandon that altogether. And that was a series of versions for a couple month period. And then we went back to dating them because they just kept evolving. And it got so ridiculous that this was a university-based study. And so I had t-shirts made that said on the front underscore last. So version control is incredibly important to document in the naming and make sure who can access it and who can modify it. And in fact, one thing that you shouldn't do, which we were doing for a while, is we had some stuff in an Excel spreadsheet and then a version of that Excel spreadsheet in the Word document. And then we were iterating on the Excel spreadsheet and they got disconnected. So after a couple months of pulling our hair out about that, we just did things in the Word document because it was anytime you have things in multiple places, things get messed up.
Right. I love the t-shirt idea. Yeah. Another question just came in. Do you find certain types of studies benefit more from the living protocol, such as observational clinical trials?
I've only done this in my observational studies. I haven't led trials, so I can't answer that. I'm sorry.
The next question is, are there aspects of your advice that could be helpful to those in operations instead of research?
Yes. I guess if operations is under much tighter timelines, then you have to think about how to do that efficiently and yet have bandwidth to do it. Mm-hmm. Since I'm not living under the Damocles sword of operations all the time, I haven't had to do that in the context of an operations funded study. So I would guess you'd have to think about how to do that efficiently. And maybe it's just always one person that does that. But that person would have to be someone who's always in on the meetings where decisions are made. I don't know what else to say.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I think that wraps up our Q&A for this afternoon. So I'm going to take the time to thank Dr. Majewski for taking the time to present today's session and providing your contact information on this slide. And then also our next session for the series is going to be 2 weeks from today on June 12th at 2 p.m. Eastern, planning for data at Project Close by our VIREC representative, Susan Salas, at the same time. And also that there are bonus slides that we have in the packet for folks, such as resources for data users, all the different websites that might be available to you, that are available to you internally. I'm going to flip back. I went forward for some reason. And those of you who have joined HSRD listserv, there's over 1,800 VA data users now who ask different questions on a very regular basis. And it's a searchable listserv as well. So you might want to consider joining that. And if you have specific questions about this session content or any other questions using VA data, please feel free to use the link under the request form on this slide to contact VIREC's help desk, ask for some background information, and we will get someone in touch with you as quickly as possible. So after leaving the session, we would like to encourage you to complete the evaluation that will be displayed on your monitor. We ask that you take a few minutes to answer those questions. We do review those responses and take feedback into consideration when planning new sessions. Thank you for attending today's session. We hope you plan to join us in the final session on June 12th. Have a great day, everyone.